Thank you.
Hello, John.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much. You can tell this is going to be a good evening because everybody's rowdy. You know, that's what we're going to. I have. Please put up your hand if you've never worked for or with Dave Oliver.
Never worked
for or with Dave Oliver.
Never known it.
You are going to have so much fun tonight. The rest of us already knew we were going to have a great time. But this is going to be an adventure because I must say, I worked with Dave, and I was frightened every day I did. Because I knew, this don't look so strange. No, I was frightened every day I did because he was out on the front end of everything trying to solve it. And sometimes with...
And I was being goaded from behind.
Well, maybe. But he was out on point and on the edge of a crisis every day. But I thought this is, you know, he was like a reactor, just this side of critical, okay? But he got more done than anybody I worked with when I was in the Pentagon. And so when he said he was going to write this book, I thought that, I can hardly wait to have a chance to read it. I've had a chance to read it, and it's fun. It's a good, fun read, but with insight. And I really do commend it to you. You'll have a wonderful time reading the book. I think you'll get a measure of his, both his intellect and his character, when you read it, and you'll get that tonight. And that's what we're going to do together. We're going to have a chance to pull this out in our conversation with him. You're all going to be part of that conversation. So I want you to dive in when we get there. I think we first should say that I don't know how many retired admirals would get out two former secretaries of the Navy, but we would like to say thanks to John Warner and Sean O'Keefe for being with us tonight. We're very honored to have you here. Thank you. Sean's sitting in the back. I never can know why, but he just is the way he is. He didn't want to be in the front line. So we're going to spend a little bit of time. Dave's going to say a few words about the book, and then I've got a couple of questions that I want to pose, and Clark I know will, and then we're going to open it up, and we're going to all be involved with this conversation. So, Dave, let me turn to you to say thank you for remarkable career of service. And that comes out, and this book is a continuation of that, because you're sharing insights that I really think everybody ought to read, especially if you're in the military, ought to read, because it's an insight in how to be an effective officer, it's an insight into how to be an effective leader. And I think you've demonstrated that. So let's turn it to you.
Thank you, and I appreciate you doing this, John, and I appreciate Clark, I appreciate you organizing this. I wrote this. There's always been a question. If you knew Admiral Rickover well, he really was sensitive about the division between leadership and management. He really felt strongly that he was it was one thing, that he was a leader, and that the two of them were inseparable. And if you did know him well, as the secretaries did, and John did, and several other people in this room did, he was a terrible leader. He was an extraordinary manager. And I don't know if I've ever seen a better manager. And he was just an awful leader. Now, Harvard, which knows nothing about lots, defines leadership as somebody who does culture changes. And by that, Admiral Rickover was a wonderful leader because he did probably the most amazing culture change you've ever seen. Right after World War II, when the submarine force had just done an extraordinary job during World War II and was at the height of public approbation, he essentially said, we can't do that again. We need to change the submarine force significantly. and that was very unpopular, and he led a culture change because to have nuclear submarines, you had to have a different culture than what was accepted. It was just extraordinary, and that was, if you define leadership that way, then that was leadership. But what happens is, if you look at all the other ways we think of leadership, he just didn't do it that well. And if you look at his career, he'd start off in submarines. He did not do well in submarines. He then went to surface ships, and he really did not do well in surface ships in command. And he transferred, and he had lots of problems in his relationship with people. And when you look at it, what happens is, he was a terribly shy person. And I know if you interacted with him, you wouldn't say that. But he was an introvert. And if you look at his history and if you knew him well, he was a terrible introvert. And he didn't do social things well. If you compare him to somebody like Admiral Zumwalt, who was another peer of his time, and I worked for both of them very closely, Admiral Zumwalt was such an extrovert and was so good at social things and could do social things as well as many senators, right? He really was good at that. But Admiral Zumwalt couldn't do any of those things. I mean, Admiral Rickover couldn't do any of those things like that. And so he retreated to working harder. And he made a mistake, candidly, and I really don't talk about it in this book, but because this is just sort of for those of us in this Beltway group. But what happens is he retreated to doing things that many managers do, which is that he retreated to working harder. And he worked at 100% all the time. You can't do that as a really good manager. You have to drop down. You have to drop down and maybe work at 80%. In diesel boats, and I started out in diesel boats, when you have the diesel boat set for a long trip, you run the diesels at 80% torque and 90% speed. And that happens to be the best way to get a long distance. Well, what happens, it also is a good way to work a long time. And the reason is that you have to have some capacity for people that are working for you when they fail to do something or they miss something because you haven't told them the way you want it done exactly. And so they drop a stitch and you need to pick it up. You need to always have that. If you're going at 100%, when they drop a stitch, you can't pick it up. Or instead of just picking it up smoothly, you yell at them instead of picking it up smoothly. And Admiral Rickover worked at 100%. And as a result, what happened is he worked really, really well with those people who worked for him who were all overachievers. He didn't work so well with those people who were the great majority who were the average overachievers. You understand what I mean? I mean, he had a lot of great people working for him, and he worked really, really well with about the top 4%. And the next 96% suffered a little tiny bit every now and then. And that introduced some friction in. If he could have throttled back a little bit, it'd have been better. And you know what? He'd enjoyed it better. But he, honest to God, he couldn't because he couldn't. And he just couldn't. He couldn't because he couldn't. Which caused me to worry about management leadership. And I worried about it enough, and this is sort of off the record, I worried about it enough that twice I wrote papers on management leadership and sent them up to him for approval, which he returned to me in smaller sized papers. and he didn't invite me to resubmit them. He just would return them to me. So I thought 30 years after he died, maybe I should go
return
ahead
and the favor.
Try again. That's all.
Okay. That's just such a wonderful little start. I mean, and I think the book. I want you to read it because it blends a fascinating history about a person, who was a fascinating person and really transformed the Navy in many ways. It brings in really remarkable insights about leadership. I know that you say he's not a leader; he was a manager. But he was a leader in a way, and I want to come back to that. And it also gives, I think, some really fine insights into the nature of the Navy. And I think we ought to try to explore each of those in this thing. So, Dave, let me just—I mean, the first thing. Let me just start. You say
Mary Beth going to come down? I know she must have read this and made notes for you.
These are my underlinings. These are mine. I mean, David, see, this is why I told you. It's so hard to goddamn manage. Unbelievable. So you write early on in this, in one of the chapters, and you say, have you ever met anyone who could look far enough ahead to plan for obstacles not yet visible? A very interesting thought. And you said that he could anticipate the future. What do you mean?
I think it's extraordinary, and I think that there are so few people that can do that, that can truly look over, not just the horizon, but look over the horizon. And when I worked at one time, I reported both to Admiral Zumwalt and to Admiral Rickover. And I thought it was extraordinary that both of them had that capability. Admiral Zumwalt, it was a time we all remember, or some of us remember, because some of us are old enough to remember. Admiral Zumwalt said at that time, it was the last couple of years of Vietnam War, he said, the threat is not Vietnam. The threat is, unless we change the Navy significantly, the Navy will be mostly black and Hispanic and female in 30 years. Unless we change the Navy, none of those three will want to join the Navy. And therefore, the most important thing is to make the Navy appeal to those three groups. And that's my role, not to win this war. And he turned to a captain that I was working for, a guy named Ken McKee, and said, you be in charge of the war. I don't want to have a report on it again. And so, which was interesting, and then I became in charge of mining Hanoi, Haiphong, and all that sort of stuff. But I thought it was really fascinating that he could see that from that position. In the same way with Admiral Rickover, who said to me one day, the problem is not whatever the heck we were working on. The problem is stop discharging any water overboard because it contains, I don't care what we've been saying about it contains any minute parts of radioactive water, we made up all this logic. Any reactive water goes overboard, contaminates the environment, stop. And what we had no tanks on board. We had no tanks offshore. We had nothing. And we had all this terrific mathematics that proved it was no problem. In fact, we were making up all sorts of stories. And Rickover said, no. And we said, wait a second, we got all this stuff. I mean, you're right. And Rickover said, I've changed my mind. Well, and somebody says, I don't agree. And Rickover says, you're fired. Next guy says, I'm going to figure a way out to solve that problem. Rickover says, okay, you can stay. Okay, okay, I understand that kind of leadership. He just saw it, and he was right. I mean, he was right. Then, 15 years later, when, who are the green people anyway?
Greenpeace
came to question it. We had 15 years of data. But they didn't come to question it for 15 years. 15 years later, and Greenpeace is fairly liberal and fairly advanced. They didn't even question it till we had 15 years of data. That's what I mean by, and that was him. I mean, I have talked to all his engineers and all that. It's the same thing. I got more exposure, radioactive exposure, than anybody else in the Navy, because if I did some stupid things and I was in the wrong places. Rickover specified that because I was on Nautilus and some other things, and I was in the desert and the wrong reactors, Rickover had specified and reduced the design exposure by a factor of 100 of what all of his staff wanted to have. And I talked to all of his staff, and I was young and stupid. I would have gone out and gotten that exposure that all the staff wanted me to have. And Rickover just said no. He just said, no, we don't understand it. I don't care what the engineering is. Cut it by 100. And I would have gotten all that exposure. As it was, I still got more than anybody else in the Navy, and yet it was all safe because Rickover had just said, we don't understand. And he'd gone around and talked. He didn't talk to Madame Curie because she was dead. He talked to her husband, though. And he talked to, who's the guy in Chicago? Ferrier. He talked to all of them. And then he came back and said, they're all wrong. They're all wrong. Rickover said, Fermi, you know, Nobel Prize winner. He said, they're all wrong. Cut it by 100. That's astounding. That he had that kind of, but you know what it is? Because I've done this every now and then myself, on some, where you think about something day and night, you're so focused, and that's the kind of person Rickover was. He only focused on the job. He was only focused, he focused on the job, he focused on his wife. She was so good looking. I mean, it's not a bad deal. But that's what he did, right? He focused on a job.
That's you or is Rickover you're talking about here?
I didn't focus on Rickover's wife. I focused on my wife.
You married well above your station. Yes. That's all I can say.
But you know, that's what he did. That's what he focused on. That's all he did.
So, Dave, let me go back. You said he wasn't a leader. He was a manager. But let me just read how you introduced this chapter on what you call planning for success. You said, you know, many people maintain that a real leader can do it all, can manage anything. They are positive they can. Rickover knew that was incorrect.
But that's, yeah, now I think leadership.
Did he do that led you to that conclusion?
I think it's astounding. This particularly happens in business. In business, what you see at companies, and you must see this, I'm particularly thinking of defense companies, because I watch this, where the guys decide what they have to do is they have to pick people who look like themselves. And they pick somebody and they bring them along, and they pick somebody who has the same qualifications. This is also true at other companies. And you watch companies where the person has gotten to be a CFO and they bring on a CFO or something. Here is Rickover, who is an engineering duty officer. In the Navy, he's not going to get an engineering duty officer, is not going to have the credibility to stand in the various fora and have the credibility as much as a line officer. We all know that. And Rickover knew that. In fact, the other problem is, as I said, Rickover weighed 125 pounds soaking wet, had a really high-pitched voice, and looked a lot like a chipmunk. Okay? At the time, the Navy in war, the diesel boat Navy lost more people in World War II than as a percentage than Marine Corps second lieutenants lost crossing the beach. You understand what I'm saying? Marine Corps second lieutenants crossing the beach, a higher percentage of them survived than the average submariner lived through World War II. Okay? You had more Medal of Honor winners, seven. There were seven Medal of Honor winners out of 35, were submariners, out of a total of 35 in the Navy. The submarine force, and the reason was, by the way, diesel submarines are a piece of crap as a warship. And so what you have to do is you have to run them with brave men. Gene Flucky came out and stayed with Linda and me in Yokosuka. And I said to Gene, "So how'd you do this?" And Gene says, it's not that goddamn hard. He says, what you do is you take the ship, a submarine, and you drive up and you get 500 feet from a ship that's 1,000 feet long. And then you shoot. And he says, that's not that hard. He says, I got a lot of kills that way. He says, and I says, well, you know, getting within 500 feet is a problem. He says, okay, that's a problem. But once you're there, those guys.
So I'm still trying to get where Rickover comes in on this story.
Rickover needed guys who looked like heroes. So he went out to get, he knew he didn't look like a hero. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he knew he wasn't. He was not an operator. So what he did was he went out to pick them. That's the reason he picked guys like Gene Wilkinson. And he picked guys like a Yogi, right? By the way, I looked up Yogi's fitness book. Yogi accused me, what did he say? He said that I did not take guidance well.
What's your point here?
Ensign, he said that of me. He said that I was, when I was an ensign, Yogi Kaufman said that when I was an ensign.
He could see the future.
Huh? Yogi okay. Kaufman didn't have a lot of judgment, doesn't have a lot. Anyway.
Okay, Clark, let me turn to you.
I'm actually here under false pretenses. I'm not a leader. I'm an analyst. I have a few leadership qualities, maybe a few management qualities. I think you two guys are doing just fine on your own. But I will ask one question as an analyst. So I read the book carefully. That's what analysts do. And
Clark has stabbed me in the back more than once. I want to point this out.
No, I beg your pardon. I've always looked you straight in the eye. So one of the first qualities you name of Rickover's management style is he was a genius. He was a genius. He could predict the future. How replicable is that as a management style? We're not all geniuses. Now, I know that he only chose geniuses to work for him like yourself, but how replicable is that in terms of a style that's going to work in a broader applicability than Rickover's nuclear submarine force?
I don't think you replicate it. I think that was his extraordinary, his own thing. It's the reason that it goes back and forth from leadership to management. I don't think you can predict when leadership comes in. I think I say someplace in there. I think what you owe it to yourself, and I think everybody owes it to himself, to try to become the best manager they can, which Rickover essentially did for the first 46 years of his career. So that if the opportunity comes to become a leader, you can seize it and make a difference for your country or for whatever you're working for. Essentially, that's what happened. Rickover was a good manager when he went to Oak Ridge when he was 46 years old. He actually was a failure in the Navy. In fact, he'd been sent there. He was in 06. He was sent there specifically to have nobody work for him. If you're in 06, even in the Navy, even in the Navy, having nobody working for you as an 06, this is not a good sign career-wise. He specifically had nobody working for him. You know, and he wasn't the most popular guy in the Navy even then. But he was a terrific manager, and he had this opportunity come up, and he seized it. And 8 years later, his picture is on the front of Time magazine. And what really happened was the President of the United States had this terrific problem. President Eisenhower has a space program that doesn't work. It isn't the Air Force's program, it's actually the Navy's program. It's run by NRL, and the first four missiles fall over on their sides while the Russians have Sputnik going around the Earth. The unemployment rate is 20% in Detroit. The United States Army, President Eisenhower's Army, is down in Arkansas preventing the whites from beating up on the black kids that are trying to integrate the schools. And the Air Force is not yet, actually the Air Force has dropped a nuclear weapon in North Carolina onto a two-bedroom home. President Eisenhower is looking for something that works. In fact, he has to go talk to Gorbachev, and Gorbachev intends to stick Sputnik in his ear, or Khrushchev intends to. President Eisenhower goes to, President Eisenhower wants a success. You got to remember that isn't that Rickover is so brilliant in a way. I mean, he is. I mean, he's really good and a lot. But it's the President of the United States that drives these things. President Truman's the guy whose initials are on the keel of the USS Nautilus. President Eisenhower's wife is the person who swings the champagne and sends Nautilus down the way. And it's President Eisenhower who doesn't tell the Chief of Naval Operations, there is no chairman at the time, who doesn't tell the Chief of Naval Operations, but goes around the Chief of Naval Operation directly to the CO of the Nautilus and tells him, I want you to go under the pole so I can send a message to the Soviets so we can get past their ice. And I want you to go under the pole, and I want you to tell anybody until you're successful. And President Eisenhower's aide says, you know you're going to kill everybody. And he tells him to leave the room. And he sends him under the pole, right? And all this goes under the pole to New York. And when they get on the pole, President Eisenhower brings the CO back to the Oval Office and gives him an award and doesn't even invite Rickover to it. Now, who is driving this train? It is not Admiral Rickover, actually Captain Rickover, actually it was Admiral by the time, but it's not Admiral Rickover. Admiral Rickover is smart enough, once that happens, to mount up his own plot, to mount up and use that himself. But he's not driving his train. This is the President of the United States using this to mount Khrushchev. Believe it or not, at the same time, because you got to remember those days, right? Eisenhower has taken his naval aide and sent him off on another nuclear submarine to go around the world in Magellan's track. And the only thing that screws this up is whoever's the U-2 pilot who doesn't use his poison pen. Gary Powers goes down, and Khrushchev brings him to the next power meeting after that. And so therefore, they can't bring the the Magellan trip up. Anyway, so Eisenhower is using the submarines, which the Soviet Union doesn't have yet, to try to balance off all this other stuff. It's President Eisenhower is driving the train on this, and Rickover hitches a ride.
Clark, you. I've got one more I'd like to ask, but
go ahead. Why don't you ask a question, and then we'll throw it open.
You know, Dave, you do go in. You already referred to it earlier in your comment, where you were talking about how Rickover foresaw the allergy that citizens would have about nuclear energy, and insisted on extraordinary safety standards to ensure that the Navy would not be a problem. What I'd like you to, this is now outside of your book, it's beyond your book, but I think you're uniquely well suited to talk about it, and that is, we don't tend to appreciate how important the Navy nuclear program has been as part of the nuclear ecosystem in this country. We've got 100 commercial nuclear reactors, and we've got 104 Navy reactors. I mean, it's been such a huge part of the ecosystem for the last 60 years of our, and the commercial side is starting to fail for different reasons. Not so much public rejection, but, you know, cost, cheap gas and things like this. That it seems to me the Navy is vulnerable if the commercial side of the ecosystem fails. So many people in the commercial side had Navy origins. Help us think about this issue. What do we do now?
The way that what happens with the, when you establish the culture of safety, the way you did it, you have a very interesting process. For example, you have to understand how you establish the culture. You establish the culture by the fact that, for example, every officer aboard spent time teaching. When I was a commanding officer, you taught a level below you. For example, everybody who was qualified as an engineer, I would teach them. And I wrote my first leadership book, which I wrote 20 years ago. I wrote that it was essentially the lectures, part of the lectures I gave my wardroom. And Rickover put in a lot of things which I don't talk about. For example, of going to a spot on the ship and standing motionless for an hour and a half, the top three officers would, because once you stand motionless for longer than half an hour, no matter what happens, you become part of the ship, and people behave as if you're part of the ship. And so they do behave as they're in their normal way. And it is a way to, people just behave normally. They just can't resist. And so you can watch that, how your training is effective. You don't do this in other ways. But it's a way you insist on keeping the standards. On the submarine, every reading is taken every hour. As a commanding officer, once a day, I reviewed every reading that was taken on the ship. When I would go down, since the human is a normal person, every night I would get up between 2 and 4 a.m. and I would drive into the ship if I were in port, and I would go down to the ship and I would walk the ship between 2 and 4 a.m. because everybody's tired then, and I wanted them to know that executive officer, engineer, officer, captain, depending on what I was going to walk through that, because it wasn't that I was going to catch them asleep. It was I wanted them to know I was going to be there every night so that they would have that energy because they knew I was going to be there. In other words, there's a whole bunch of things you do aboard nuclear ships you don't do other places. It is a completely different form of culture than anything, and then commercial nuclear or anything else, because you have a, because Rickover instilled that there is a pact that you have of safety with the commercial, with the civilian life. So I don't know commercial. I know what the culture is, because that's maintained with the nuclear side, with the Navy side.
Well, I don't think we would have a commercial industry without having Rickover having established a culture of excellence.
He did it by way, but it's different.
But we are going to, I think, be vulnerable as a country if commercial nuclear energy disappears, because that means the Navy alone has to carry the scale of this industry. And we need to think about it as a national security issue. Okay, let's open up. Let's see if there are some questions that we have from our audience before we let you return to the bar. Yes,
and
please.
And buy some books.
And buy the book, please. Do we have a microphone? It's a small enough room. Just stand up and you have a loud voice.
Okay.
Good.
On your book, Lead On, and also a thread in your current book, Against the Tide, there seems to be a fine line between getting extraordinary results, achievements, and insubordination. If you could comment on that fine line.
No, he doesn't want to.
Rickover Rickover wrote and gave a speech at the postgraduate school in Monterey in 1954, and enlisted some really fascinating things. One of which was that he said, if you didn't argue with your boss, and you weren't insubordinate with him, then he really didn't want you around. This is really a hard thing for most companies to deal with, particularly. It's actually not bad in the Navy. Most of the Navy, they'll deal with it. I know this because I was court-martialed 3 times for insubordination. And each time I was cleared. I was convicted of insubordination, but they decided that I was right, and so therefore... Now, I don't recommend this as a normal career pattern. But the Navy is fair in those cases, but it wastes a lot of admirals' time, so I don't recommend it. But Rickover was fine with this. I mean, as Linda knows, my brother knows this too, because he was there when I did one of these with Rickover. I have problems with that line. Anyway, but Rickover didn't have any problem with that. Rickover was cool with that. Most companies have a lot of problem with that, right? Most companies just can't stand that at all. They can't stand, they really, I've found companies are worse with that than military organizations, actually. Military organizations, you can state what you think much more clearly than you can in a company. sir.
I had some peripheral contact with you in the FDM program in the 60s. I was suffering from the wall. And the Admiral would come and visit once or twice a year. And there was evident fear in advance of his visits. I'd just like you to comment on the role fear actually has in leadership or management.
I don't think it's good. No, I'm serious. I don't think it's good. I think it's destructive. I think fear is destructive. I always think it is. In fact, I mentioned it in a book. I think that fear, I don't think organizations use fear properly. If you have fear, then you're not using it, you're not focusing it to figure out why it is. And I agree with you that the Admiral's visits engendered fear. I just don't think they were focused it on why. Now, Linda will tell you that she didn't think I was afraid enough of the Admiral, and that was a problem. And there's a story in a book about one thing that I did that was disgusting. There's a whole bunch of guys who were my classmates that, when I laughed at the Admiral in public one time, and there was a problem with them. You need to be comfortable with it, but you need to take fear and focus it on what it really is deserved. It's focused on, right? And you need to know what it is. The Admiral, I'll give you what happened. Here's the thing. The Admiral really thought that people should not make rules, but they ought to think. And he just would go, he perhaps lost his temper every now and then, because people like to make rules so they can train. So people would make rules about getting people, he would say, we don't need to get people contaminated, you know, get radioactivity on. So they'd make rules. So what happens is he would simulate that a guy had broken his leg and was bleeding. And yet, what happened was he was also contaminated, lightly contaminated. Well, all of us who are truly and understand nuclear things realize being lightly contaminated is not that big a deal. But since he's lightly contaminated and having a broken leg with blood coming out, it is actually a big deal. And so what happens is they don't treat the broken leg. And Rickover would go crazy. Because here's this guy who's in great pain and is dying, and nobody's treating it because they're worrying about the broken leg. And so he would fail this whole shipyard. And I'll give you a little story. Here's this thing that happened one time. It's on a submarine, so you have to take him out via litter, which is mechanical, which is metal, right? And so they drop a chain hoist down, and I'm watching this, and I'm standing over. The person who was the head of was a woman. God, she was gorgeous, wasn't she? Linda's a great friend of Linda's, thank God, or else I couldn't say that. And we're great friends with she and her husband. And I was standing over it, and she's head of radioactive something. And we're watching it. And I'm watching this because it's my ship, and I'm supposed to watch it while my guys are trained. And they drop this thing down, and they bring this guy over, and he's strapped this litter. And as they bring it out, the hoist slips and grabs around the guy's neck. And so they hoist him out of the ship by his neck. Well, this is not good. And people start screaming, and the hoist operator sees he's strangling this guy, and he lets go of the hoist. Except now he's suspended in the air, and he's off the ship. So it goes into the water, and it's a metal litter, right? So people jump in into 60 feet of water, and they have five guys jump in, and they bring the guy up, and they get him out, except they're still worrying about the fact that they want to pass this exam. And so they get him up onto the pier, and they get him up, and by this time, here comes the ambulance, and it comes down the pier, and it's got these ruts from the tracks from the thing,
grain,
yeah. And the ambulance, and the guy puts it in a power slide, and he slides it around, and he comes down, and the guys leap out, and they throw open the doors, and the guys go up, and they throw the litter in there, and they slam the doors shut, and the guys hop in the front, and they pull off, power, take off, and the doors pop open, and the litter goes out on the wheels, and it goes down the end, and it hits off the end of the pier, and it tips up, and it goes off the end where it's 80 feet, not 50. And they go, and the five guys look at each other, and then they start running for the end of the pier, and they go in again. And she says, what was her name, Deirdre? Deirdre says, you know, I think I'll just write my resignation letter right now. And she walks in there, and she writes, I quit. Deirdre, whatever the hell her name was. Deirdre, whatever, and she writes it, and she just takes her pen, and she goes, dunk, and snacks it to their ladder, and she picks up her briefcase, and she says, will you give me a ride home? And I says, might as well. It's not going to be a lot of going on here for a couple of days. And I gave her a ride home because I knew the shipyard was going to get shut down because there was not, you know, we watched the guy get saved.
Twice.
But, you know, and that sort of thing tended to make the Admiral unhappy.
Jim.
I'd like to go back to your interest and concern of the commercial nuclear industry as vis-a-vis the Navy. And there have been a lot of, Corbin McNeil, a tremendous addition to the civilian industry. Is the command and control mechanism in the civilian industry don't allow the kind of disclosure that allow that embarrasses for-profit executives, or they squelch the kind of disclosure that's, at least in the Navy, there's a new process where you can be a subordinate officer like you and court-martial for several times, but there's a new process. How do we translate that into the civilian?
I don't know. I don't know anything about that.
Senator.
Thank you very much. I feel very humbled by being part of this group tonight. And I'll pose my question to you, Skipper, so you can think about it, but I want to take 2 minutes before time to talk. And I also ask you, John, thank you for hosting this. But think about the question you posed about the survivability of the civilian side of this and give us your own answer as to what we should do. My question to you, Admiral, why the hell did you wait so long to write this down? Because America should understand, and we here gathered tonight should understand, that in all probability we're here because of the contributions of Admiral. I was privileged to serve in the Naval Secretary in 69-74, 5 years, 4 months, 3 days. And in that period of time, I say with deep humility, I had a lot of work in good times and stressful times with the Admiral. I start off with one of the more amusing, and there's an old saying, a picture's worth a thousand words. So I wrote a picture. I'll contribute a few words before I tell the picture. I felt that as the years rolled on and I got to knowing that this man was entitled to the recognition for what he does. And along the way, as we all know in this room, he was gathered a lot of angst and animosity among his own fellow citizens. He was a department under his own. There was a Navy budget, and there was a Rickover budget. And he gave little pause to what the Navy budget was, but he took whatever they gave him, and then proceeded to immediately go to Capitol Hill and get Scoop Jackson and Scoop the others I can mention, and concoct what he really needed to supplement his own budget. And there was no means by which that flow of money would ever be stopped, and it came. And thank the good Lord, it did come. But anyway, I decided he needed some recognition. the heart and the soul of the Navy, and that's Annapolis, from which he graduated. And we're building a brand new engineering building. So I decided I was the secretary, I had to write the name of the IMG Rickover School of Engineering. So the advocate said, no. Put the thing anywhere you want, but not in Annapolis. No, we want our own school of engineering. We want no part of it. And so I reminded him that the civilian consultant was cutting off. So now I want to tell the admiral about it. So I called him to my office and he came, and he always wanted to come at 8 o'clock at night. And he wanted everybody else out of the office. And he wanted free range to talk to me, unfettered, undisturbed, and his voice would rattle and shake the doors for 3 offices down each way. And we'd have our rows and then eventually set the dial. So he sat there very pensively and he said, what's the nature of your inquiry, Secretary? And I said, Admiral, I've decided that I'm going to name the new engineering building at Annapolis, the Hyman G. Rickover Engineering School. The only time I saw him momentarily lose a fraction of control. You could tell his eyes were upward. He was slightly off guard and speechless. But then he regained his composure and he blasted out at me, and I cannot use in this company the word he but I will substitute in a reasonable way. He said, the rascals who ripped the name off the wall the day I died. And I very calmly turned to him and I said, Admiral, as usual, you're right. They will. Well, what are you going to do about it? I said, first you're going to show up in full uniform and you will learn what I have done to protect the integrity of your name and this building. Fast forward, ceremony in Annapolis, brief as though it be, right in front of the building. And I had instructed the chief engineer to strip the fire protection on the main bearing column in the front hall of the room, and to build a solid 3-inch steel plaque welded to the wall. Have it out there so nothing could happen. Then bring the welder and have the welder at the ceremony. And when the admiral arrives, after I've said a few opening remarks, have the welder weld his initial in the plaque. So there's the picture. You can't see it from here. But this is the plaque, and it has Rickover right there. That's the Navy nurse that protected him so much and brought him to a terrible health situation he had in the he has his 4 stripes on now. That's his lovely wife. This is the superintendent of the academy. Absolutely opposed. And my picture is a little document over there. But it's still there today. I was at Annapolis not long ago, privy to say a few words to midship, and it's still there. But that man, really, in this period of the 5 years I was there, it was the Cold War. And little is known about the Cold War, but it was really a question of leveraging authority and science and technology by both the Soviet Union and the United States. And our concept of the strategic defense was to try air, sea, and ground. And I won't go into that, but we knew that the sea play was the strongest so long as our technology was always advanced to the Soviets, and they knew just enough about how far we were ahead to prevent their leveraging us for other goals in that period of time. And every morning we started on 7 o'clock with our intel briefing. Well, where are the Yankees tonight? And that was the Soviet submarine, offshore my state, Virginia, by a few hundred miles, free-ranging the East Coast to a Congress to give him his 4-star. That, too, was not what the Admiral. So I was able to get a special statute which set it aside for 4-star. Should not have competition. And he wore his uniform with the 4 stars on it for that one time. I don't think he did it very often, because he hung up his Rear Admiral's uniform in his closet and never bought the gold braid.
I think that's
the answer to the question. Why did you wait so long?
Because when I worked for you for those 2 years, it set me back, Mr. Mr. Chairman, it sent me back. Let's go to what John's answer is. That's a much more interesting.
Well, I bring it up to say that I believe as long as I live, we're going to still depend on a nuclear retaliatory force to protect the country. I think it's going to be a Navy force over time. I think it's the one that's reliable and secure. But I think that Navy nuclear force is... It's because it's part of a larger nuclear ecosystem. If we see the collapse of commercial nuclear energy in this country, it puts at risk our capacity to be able to support the Navy. And I think it's important for us to feel strongly about national security, that we take a fresh look at our national need to keep this industry viable. And I think it's maybe esoteric, but in the long run, the momentum of losing commercial nuclear energy in this country would be a serious blow to a nuclear Navy that we have to have for our security. Anyway, let's just say thanks to Dave for what I think is a remarkable book. It's for sale out there. Please buy it. You're going to enjoy it. It's a very well-written book. And thank him for this work. Thanks, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.